Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
It's no surprise to anybody that pro football in Western Pennsylvania is a big deal. And November 12th is one of the biggest days of the year because there's a handful of items and events that happen on November 12th connected with Pittsburgh pro football that you might not know about. So here's a handful coming up with our friend Ryan Minig of the 304 Collector Corner that joins us with parts of his collection to help tell a tale right after this.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to this special November 12th edition where here in Western Pennsylvania, we are celebrating football very special today because we have three events that happened centered around Pittsburgh and football. And I had to bring in a specialist here to help me with this one because it's a big day, a big Steelers fan, big Steelers poster on social media. He also has a new Substack, Ryan Minig of the 304 Collector Corner. Ryan, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. I always enjoy being in the Pigpen. I've told you once, I'll tell you a million times. Any day we can talk football history, we're having a great day.
Right, and we get to talk a couple, the two of these three are very Steelers-oriented. The first one goes a little bit before them, but maybe if you want to, you know, maybe introduce our first one and tell us a little bit about this event.
Yeah, absolutely. So honestly, I think what we need to start the petition for first is for November 12th to be a sports holiday in Pittsburgh. We need to start that one first. So
we can extend it to whole Western Pennsylvania, so I get the day off too. We get up here in Erie too. So
perfect. It all counts. It's all part of the program. So dating back before the Steelers and well before the National Football League, November 12th holds a significance as kind of the birth of professional football. William Pudge Heffelfinger, which I'm sure a name that NFL historians are well aware of, but for fans who may not know, Pudge was the first paid professional football player. It was paid by the Allegheny Athletic Association. He was paid $500 to be the first professional football player. Now, the caveat to that being is that we didn't know that until the 1960s. It was often accepted that John Browlier. Mm-hmm. I always struggle with that. I don't think I've ever actually said it out loud. But was
the Latrobe Historical Society, where he is from and where he played, they call him Browlier. So
Browlier. Yeah. Perfect. I will trust them because they're going to know better than me. They probably said it out loud. So John Browlier was often considered the first football player. And the thing that I always find funny about that is the difference of the money, because Pudge obviously being paid $500 and Browlier was paid $10 plus expenses for his services. So I would kind of hate to find that out so many years later that I was not $490 more expensive for what I was doing. But it is a very significant day because what we know today, although it looked much different in 1892, this is the day that we should celebrate as the birth of pro football. Thank you to Pudge Heffelfinger for accepting that money.
Yeah, he was a big time star. You know, as we know, college football was king from, you know, when its inception, basically the early 1880s, when it really became recognizable as football with some of the football codes being changed, all the way through you know, the 1958 greatest game ever played, or I guess you could even say when television came out, college football by far was king. Pudge Heffelfinger was the face of college football in the 1880s, late 1880s, early 1890s. And to get a star like that who was a tackle, and you know, today we think of, you know, left tackles being really high paid people, but the tackles, you know, they could run the ball, they had the tackles back formations, and these guys were studs, not only as blockers and tacklers, but you know, they could run the ball as well. And yeah, Pudge Heffelfinger was a big name to be signed. So he demanded big money. That's why he got $490 more than Brailleur got a few years later.
I do also find it funny that with all the competition in Pittsburgh, obviously there's the early Pittsburgh Athletic Club, Allegheny Athletic Association, but the Samlot teams of the 20s, the competition in Pittsburgh has always been fierce. There's always a rivalry when those Pittsburgh teams were playing each other. You could even equate that to the college game with like Pittsburgh and Duquesne in the 20s and 30s. There's always that crosstown rivalry. And it's so funny to read the accounts of the Pittsburgh Athletic Club saying, "Well, you paid players." And like, "No, we didn't." Only to find out some 60 years later that we paid a large sum of money so we could beat you.
Now there was some rumors. Okay, so Pudge actually ended up playing for the Allegheny Athletic Club, the AAA they called themselves. The game they were playing was against the Pittsburgh Athletic Club, the PAA. But there was rumors that the PAA was trying to sign Pudge also, and they got in a bidding war. And you know, Pudge finally said, "Okay, you're gonna give me $500. I'm going with you guys," and went with Allegheny, and the rest is history. So pretty cool there too.
So we also need to give him credit for being the first free agent of professional football history. All right.
Yeah, most definitely. It's kind of neat how that story broke too. Now, maybe you can correct me on it if I'm wrong, but the basic gist of it is, you know, Brailleur was the by far accepted way, you know, in Latrobe, which is not far from Pittsburgh. It's like 40 minutes away from downtown Pittsburgh. And, you know, and Latrobe would play against these Pittsburgh Athletic Clubs and Allegheny Athletic Clubs too, in later years play against some of the other clubs. But it was, you know, 60 some years later, somebody brought a document, and I think it was to one of the Rooneys, and laid it down and sort of didn't want to have his name said or anything, just sort of left a whole box of papers, I guess, and this was one of them, this ledger from the Allegheny Athletic Club that had William Heffelfinger $500 on that date of November 12th, 19 or 1892. So kind of a cool story there too.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think it's funny that when you think of kind of the history of Pittsburgh football, that even the discovery of the first player ties back to the Rooneys, because everybody equates the Rooneys with Pittsburgh and football, and they have such a deep history in. And I know they weren't there for the actual beginning with Heffelfinger and Brailleur, but at the same point, they have such a deep connection to it that it even goes back to them finding out who the first player was. So I do like that story. But I think John Brailleur also deserves credit. I know he's not the feature of this day. But for the longest time, we did accept him too. And my mind also says that we have vastly underrated what Dave Barry did for professional football too.
No, most definitely, most definitely. My first book was on a 1903 team from Franklin, and that was sort of the end of Pennsylvania's run at pro football in the early years until basically 1933, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. You know, the resurgence of football in Western Pennsylvania, but Western Pennsylvania owned pro football from 1892 right up through 1903. And that Franklin team that I wrote about bought out everybody. The Dave Barry led, you know, Pittsburgh Stars, the Philadelphia Athletics, and the Philadelphia Phillies had the original National Football League teams, which Franklin bought all their stars and basically, you know, ended the organization after 1 year of the league. So, kind of a cool story there too. But yeah, great stuff for Western PA.
Yeah, great little start to the Pittsburgh lore of November 12th.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so what is our next event that happened on November 12th that's famous for Pittsburgh football?
Yeah, so I guess we'll kind of jump around a little bit because it's a birth. So in 1927, the Steelers Hall of Fame defensive back Jack Butler was born. So Butler obviously not playing in the 20s and 30s. He played in the 1950s. And I mentioned Dave Barry being vastly underrated. I think I don't think people understand quite how good Jack Butler was in the 1950s. I think even though he's a Hall of Famer, I think people undervalue what he did for that defense. Although the Steelers weren't a great team in the 1950s by any stretch, they had one of the best defenses in football routinely throughout that stretch. And there's multiple publications that even kind of credit that to say Pittsburgh's defense is great, but the offense doesn't have the firepower. And obviously guys like Ernie Stotner, Jack Butler, Dale Dodrell, and others. But Jack Butler, one of the stats that I still think of to this day, that, and I think this is why it's important to contextualize history. And I know you know this, Darren, and I know some of your listeners know this too. But Jack Butler retired with the second most interceptions in NFL history. He was tied with Bobby Dillon when he retired in 1959, only trailing Emlyn Tennell. But if you ask people today, they would look at it and say, I'm not sure where he is on the list today, but they would say, oh no, he's 25th on the list. Why 25th? Doesn't really matter. In his time, he was amazing. So I think what we lose about Jack Butler is sort of that history. We look at him more in terms of what we're looking at right now. But looking back, if you put him in that era and put him up against those guys, he was as good as anybody.
Yeah, and I mean, think about from this perspective too. He had the most interceptions, or second most interceptions when he retired, but the passing game is nowhere near what it is today. People were not putting the ball in the air, you know, 40 times, 50 times in a game. This is, you know, the era of, okay, we run the ball, and when we get in a little bit of trouble from, you know, long yardage, you throw the pass. That's your desperation for most teams. You know, I think it was probably more like a 66, you know, 33 split with running being more prevalent. So you didn't have as many opportunities to pick off passes. And so that's pretty remarkable to have that many picks in that type of play.
And there were a lot of other good backs too. And again, defensive formations don't look the same in 1950 as they do now, and nor do offensive formations. But to that same point, looking at other stats, again, to kind of contextualize history a little bit. So if you look at Steelers history, I think most people, if you would say, who's the greatest defensive back in Steelers history? Most people are going to come right out and say Troy Polamalu, Rod Woodson, Mel Blount. But if you look at it from this statistical standpoint, Jack Butler, in Steelers history, only six seasons has a player had more than nine interceptions. And Jack Butler has three of them. So half of those seasons are Jack Butler. And he's one of only four with more than 10 interceptions. So I can't imagine, if I would have known more than I did in the 2000s and 2010s, I would have absolutely been banging the door for him to get into Canton much earlier than he did in 2012.
Yeah, it's 2012. It's amazing that he got in after most of the 1970s Steelers, you know, the majority of them were in way before 2012. And he was, I mean, all NFL Hall of Fame class of 1950. I mean, when you're an all decade team, that should almost be automatic. You should be Hall of Fame. That means your peers think you were the best player at your position for those 10 years. And it's remarkable that, and really a travesty that, he didn't get in until 2012, but sure glad he is now that we get to enjoy and see his bust and relive some of his history when people visit Canton. So that's kind of cool.
One of the other fun things about him, though, that maybe lesser known is, and I don't remember the exact number, I should have put it in my note, but he had a handful of reception touchdowns too. When they brought him over to the offense, he was a receiving threat. I believe he has like seven career reception touchdowns, something of that number. So if he wasn't picking off passes, they could put him on offense to be a weapon too.
Yeah, we forget about that it's right in the era where single platoon is on its way out, but some teams are still saying, we don't want to have that many specialists because the roster sizes were much smaller. I think they only had less than 30 players on an NFL roster, so you had to be able to do multiple duties and do them well to play in that era. Because they didn't have the payrolls that they have today either. So
No.
yeah. So yeah, definitely Jack Butler, an important part of Pittsburgh history, and he was a Pittsburgh guy. He was born in the city. So when you have your hometown hero playing for your Pittsburgh Steelers, that makes it even more special. It doesn't happen very often, and really great thing for him.
No, great to have Butler as a Steeler because of all those legendary marks, but kind of leading into the last one now, because I know people. We've jumped around to the 50s a little bit, so I think we should take them back to the beginning of the Steelers franchise to really give them the roots of Pittsburgh. So the last being 1933, which is the inaugural Steelers season, or the inaugural Pirate season, if you want to be era correct. This November 12th was the day of the first Sunday home game for the Steelers after the Blue Laws were repealed. The first home games that they played that season were all on Wednesday, which reminiscent of probably COVID a little bit. I'm sure we all remember that whenever we're watching games on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, just whenever we could play them. But in 1933, that was the first Sunday home game. Now, unfortunately, it was forgettable, losing to Brooklyn. I have the score here. I actually have them back to back. Or maybe not. I wrote them the wrong. Oh, there we go. So 32-0. They were shut out in their first ever Sunday home game, which was a little shocking because the week before playing in Brooklyn, they played to a 3-3 tie. So I guess Brooklyn made the adjustments, not Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's definitely right. Now, it's really kind of an interesting story. When you think about the early NFL and why games are played on Sundays, we just grew up saying, hey, NFL is played on Sundays. Well, now they've expanded to other days of the week. But back in the day, it was Sunday, most of your games were played that day. And the reason is because, like we said earlier, college football was such a powerhouse, and they would not have anybody going to an NFL game if they tried to play it on a Saturday. And Sunday was also a good day because most of the workers, it was a lot of industrial towns were playing in the NFL, in the early NFL. And Sundays was a day of rest, and people didn't have to go to work, and good time to go to catch a ball game. And they wanted to take your money to sell you tickets to come and do that too. So the being the repealing of the Blue Laws, which happened at the general election that year in on November 7th of 1933. And if you check, those of you that check our daily posts on football history, you can remember reading that back on November 7th here just a few days ago. That general election, the NFL sort of knew, the Rooneys and the Bells knew that it was going to be repealed, and the Blue Laws were. So that's why the franchises were bought and they were started. And it would have been really, really bad for them if that vote didn't go through and they play these Wednesday games, because nobody would want to play them and say, okay, go pound salt. Your guys' franchises are over. But yeah, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, and kind of in a roundabout way, looking at what Burt Bell and Dart Rooney did to kind of give us what we have today. I know it wasn't a direct one for one, hey, we're playing on Sundays, but to give us the big fame and lights that we have today of the NFL is pretty cool to think about, that it dates back to some of the earliest days of the NFL and some of our most historic figures.
Yeah, it definitely does. And we did have pro football during the 1920s in Pennsylvania, but they were mostly on the east side. Those of you who just read the book that Jeffrey Payne and I wrote this year, we just had the 100th anniversary of the Pottsville Maroons. They were in there, and Pottsville would play on Saturdays, but I'm sorry, they played on Sundays. They didn't care about the Blue Laws. I don't know, Pottsville didn't have them cracking down on them, I guess, but the Frankford Yellow Jackets did care about it, being in Philadelphia. So they would play on Sundays, but that's how those teams thrived. They were both powerhouses, but teams would come from Chicago or Green Bay or New York or wherever, and come and play one on Saturday, one on Sunday, a home and home game. And, poor guys playing, 2 days in a row. That was pretty brutal, especially when you're traveling all the way from Chicago or, wherever to come and do that. So, but they ended basically the late 1920s, 1928, I think was the last that Pottsville and Frankfurt played. But Frankfurt actually turned into the franchise. I'm sorry, Frankfurt went a little bit longer. They went in the 1930s. They had like a year or two off. And Burt Bell, actually his son Upton, who I've had on the show multiple times, has told the story often to say that Burt Bell and his wife, Upton's mother, Frances Upton, who's a vaudeville starlet, they bought the franchise of Frankfurt and renamed it to Philadelphia Eagles, and rest is history.
Yeah, and we have great figures to remember. Again, great figures to remember all that by, to give us the history that we have today. Now, speaking of that, I actually have one more November 12th occurrence, if you're up for one more.
Yeah, we'll always take a bonus.
Maybe this one isn't quite as famous. It's not Jack Butler. It's not Pudge Heffelfinger. But I was talking with my friend on X. If you all were on X, you may know who Steel City Star is. We were talking a little bit about November 12th as well. And it is the only game ever that the Pittsburgh Steelers played the Baltimore Colts. Now, that sounds crazy because it's not. But as you football fans will know, the All-American Football Conference, the AAFC in the 1940s, had the Baltimore Colts, and they were one of the franchises that carried over to the NFL. In 1950, they played their first season in the NFL along with San Francisco and Cleveland, but that iteration of the Colts folded after 1950. So that franchise was kind of defunct after 1950, bought back in 1952 as the Dallas Texans, only to then be the Baltimore Colts again in 1953. So that's technically speaking the only time that the Steelers played the Baltimore Colts, and also a record.
And played the original Baltimore Colts, I guess.
Correct. Yeah, okay. The original Baltimore Colts, which seems strange to say that they only played one season, but in context, that's actually true. And a Steelers record was actually set that day too. Quarterback, running back, kicker, punter, do-it-all guy Joe Gary actually set at the time the single season record for field goals for the Steelers as well in that game.
Wow, that is some great information. I did not know that, but we'll include that with our November 12th celebration here. And Pittsburgh is really waving the flags here for football, and November 12th is a very special day that most people don't know that even live in the Steel City. So we're glad that you were able to come here and help us preserve this and share it with others. And, like we said, we'll petition to get the governor to make a November 12th Pittsburgh Pro Football Day.
I'm going to start writing my letter now because we're going to take all of our notes from this show and just transcribe it on official letterhead. It's time.
All right. Well, Ryan, really appreciate you coming in here and sharing this information with us, helping preserve the history. Why don't you tell us where people can see your works? I know you got some new projects out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Darren mentioned earlier, I go by the moniker of 304 Collector Corner, on socials. You can find me on Facebook, X, Instagram. I'm on Threads, Blue Sky, and I just started my Substack. My Substack's a little bit more of a collection of helping you collect. As a collector myself, I feel it's important to kind of give people a cost-efficient way to collect and the full scope of collecting, not just the big money cards that everybody sees. But I post a lot about Steelers history, Pittsburgh sports history, but you can find me pretty much anywhere where social media is had.
Yeah, and great project that you've been working on for months here is that Pittsburgh Steelers rookie collection that many of us have saw on social media. And if you haven't seen it yet, go check it out, folks, because it's really cool what he's done. And maybe you could explain that real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. So my original goal was to collect one card of every single Pittsburgh Steeler ever, a rookie card. Come to find out that not all of them have cards. So what I tried to do then was collect an item that depicts every single Steeler ever, whether that be a card, a program, a photo, a media guide, anything that would have these players represented. And I'm down to double digits now. We are inching in on this being completely over. We'll probably redo a little bit of content to go back to see some of these things, but it's been a lot of fun hunting all of these almost 1700 guys.
Wow. That's amazing. And just worrying about the rookie card or rookie item, I guess, is that's really a cool project. Very unique. And I don't think you're going to find that anywhere else but on Ryan and his social media channels and his Substack. So Ryan, really appreciate that. Folks, if you didn't, we're driving in a car, couldn't write down where to get Brian's connection. We'll have a link in the show notes of the YouTube channel and the podcast and on pigskindispatch.com. Ryan, thanks again for joining us and help us celebrate November 12th.
Thanks, Darren. I appreciate it.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.